Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the crisis in Ukraine, the main instigator of which Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning is on the brink of civil war. The former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, Stephen Piper, joins us to discuss whether talks between the U.S., Russian and Ukrainian foreign ministers scheduled in Geneva on Thursday will avert a shooting war and what the weak government in Kiev can do to reassure its citizens in the east to prevent further destabilization of the country by Russian political tourists and intelligence and paramilitary agents who have thoroughly infiltrated Ukraine's eastern provinces. Then we will speak with Joan Claybrook, the former administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, who wrote a joint letter with Clarence Ditlow, the executive director of the Center for Auto Safety, to GM CEO Mary Barra, saying that newly released GM documents are an obscure but smoking gun that, quoting, paint a tragic picture of the cost culture and cover-up at GM. We will discuss revelations in these internal GM documents that show the company considered, then rejected, a safer ignition switch in 2001, which they later in 2006 quietly provided as a replacement part after 32 crashes in which 13 people died. Then finally, we will look into former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg's $50 million challenge to the NRA aimed at the hearts and minds of America so that we can protect our children, protect innocent people from gun violence. Daniel Webster, a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, and the director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, joins us to discuss the launch of Every Town for Gun Safety and whether it will curb gun violence in what Bloomberg notes is the only civilized country in the world that has this problem. Joining us now is Stephen Piper, the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kiev, he has had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ambassador Stephen Piper.
Thank you for having me.
And Russian President Vladimir Putin is warning Ukraine, warning that Ukraine is on the brink of civil war. This, of course, is a bit disingenuous since he's both being the arsonist and the fire brigade in destabilizing eastern Ukraine. What's your sense of how things are unfolding on the ground? There are conflicting reports of local people being offended by the Ukrainian military that's coming in. And there's also some reports of eastern Ukrainians being offended by the so-called political tourists coming in from Russia.
Yeah, well, you have a very difficult situation over the last 10 to 12 days in eastern Ukraine, where you've now had in about 8 or 10 cities and towns, armed people taking over police stations or city halls or regional administration buildings. I mean, on one point, there is some unease in eastern Ukraine about whether their political and economic interests are being fully represented by the acting government in Kyiv. I don't think anybody that's serious would deny that. But you've also, until these last 10 days, have not seen a big separatist push in the region. And it does look, when you see these various operations coming off in a very coordinated way, like there may be some instigation. And in this case, I tend to agree with what the Ukrainians say, which is that this has been organized by Moscow.
Well, there are reports of a Ukrainian soldier and an officer whose car broke down being held prisoners by pro-Russian Ukrainians or even Russians. Also, some of these armored vehicles apparently have been taken over by pro-Russians or Russians. It's difficult to know the distinction, right, between pro-Russian eastern Ukrainians and political tourists.
No, I think there has been that question. Although the Ukrainians, I believe, actually had some success in reducing the number of what they call political tourists, Russians who cross the border and then go take part in demonstrations, in part because they've tightened up the controls at the border checkpoints when people come across. But of greater concern now is that when you look and you've seen a number of examples on the video, when you look at some of the people who seem to be in charge of these takeovers, they have a very professional military bearing. A lot of Ukrainians, they use the term little green men. This was the term that they used to refer to the people who were very professional in combat uniforms in Crimea who did not have any insignia to identify them. And what they're saying now in Kyiv is some of those little green men have appeared in eastern Ukraine.
So what's your sense then, Stephen Pfeiffer, of this brinksmanship? Obviously, Russia warned Ukraine or threatened them not to retaliate against the occupation of these government buildings by these so-called pro-Russian Eastern Ukrainians. And the government in Kyiv finally acted, and they've sent troops in. They've captured an airfield, but it's sort of doubtful about the success of the operation so far. And that's where we're at, right? I mean, this is really a tinderbox, isn't it?
I think the actions, which again, I believe have been inspired by Russian special services, really do put the acting government in Kyiv in a dilemma. Because on the one hand, they can try to reassert control. They can try to retake some of these buildings, which runs the risk of bloodshed. And that possibly creates a pretext which the Russians may be looking for broader action against Ukraine. And they still have reportedly 30 to 40,000 troops along the Ukrainian border. That's one option. The other option, though, is to stand back and do nothing and then watch this series of takeovers continue and in effect lose eastern Ukraine by a stealthy default. My impression is that the government has tried to be, has been restrained. I mean, it's tried to not have to use force, but they now may feel that they're in a position where they have no other choice.
Again, I'm speaking with Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine, and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine, and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kyiv, he had had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva, and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. So this meeting that's to take place in Geneva of the foreign ministers of the U.S., Russia, and Ukraine, that's at least a plus, isn't it? I mean, it seems so far that it's been the Kerry Lavrov show, and the Ukrainians don't even get a place at the table to discuss their own fate. So does this look like an improvement that the Ukrainian foreign minister will be in on those meetings?
That would be a positive development, and my sense is there's actually been quite a bit of sensitivity on the American side. They've not been comfortable talking about Ukraine with Foreign Minister Lavrov without Ukraine in the room. And my understanding is, in fact, that the U.S. government has made a lot of effort to be talking to the Ukrainian government before those meetings to make sure that they don't get crosswise with what Kyiv wants. But the meeting tomorrow, if it happens, there have been a couple of suggestions that the Russians at the end might not come, but at least as of today, Foreign Minister Lavrov says he is coming. It will be good because you have Ukraine at the table. And then the question is, can the meeting then begin to define a course that begins to diffuse and de-escalate the crisis and move towards more of a political dialogue? And a lot will depend on what Mr. Lavrov brings, whether he's prepared to take some steps that would, in fact, diffuse the crisis.
But Ambassador Stephen Pfeiffer, it seems, though, that using the analogy that Putin is both the arsonist and the fire brigade, it looks like there's another little fire starting in Transnistria, which is a Russian-dominated population-wise. I think 97% of the population in this little enclave in Moldova are Russians. And now they're sending a delegation to Moscow on Thursday. That all feels orchestrated, too. So is this what Putin's strategy is, just to continually to throw the Ukrainian government off base? And I take it he does not want this May 25th election to take place.
Yeah, I would focus. I'd be more concerned about what's transpiring now in eastern Ukraine. And again, no, you're right. If the Russians want to see the situation in Ukraine diffuse, they need to stop trying to destabilize it. And that is an important point. The May 25 election would be very important for Ukraine. It's an opportunity for there to be a new president who will have renewed democratic legitimacy, and that would remove some of the questions that hang over how the current acting government came into play. I think the current government came into play in a very understandable way politically, but probably did not check all the right constitutional boxes in terms of the formal removal of President Yanukovych, who basically abdicated when he fled the Capitol back on February 21. But that election would be very important in investing somebody with renewed democratic legitimacy. Ukraine knows how to do free and fair elections, but there is this question, do the Russians want to have that happen? The Russians have already talked about postponing the election. They would like to have constitutional change first. And my guess is that the Russians aren't eager to see that election come off, and they may find ways to try to derail that process.
But I don't know how much Putin is in an alternative universe. That was suggested by German Chancellor Angela Merkel after a long phone conversation. She thought that he was on another planet. But assuming that he's getting a broad input of advice from both the oligarchs and the military, and not just listening to his coterie of KGB cronies, the Russian people are in a totally alternative universe, aren't they? Their media is telling them the fascists and neo-Nazis and anti-Semites have taken over Ukraine and are persecuting Eastern pro-Russian Ukrainians in the East, and that's leading to this kind of war fever that's gripping the Russians. Even Medvedev the Prime Minister tweeted a remark about fascists and neo-Nazis taking over and the CIA director making a secret visit. What was that all about? What was John Brennan doing visiting, you know?
Well, I don't think we really have any information on what he was. I've seen one media report that suggested he was there to talk about ways that there could be enhanced communication with the Ukrainian government. You know, one of the issues I think that's been out there is over 20 years is the Ukrainian Security Service. It was never quite sure whether it actually had gone through the process to ensure that it was totally separate from Russian influence. But I think on the broader question here is, in Moscow, in Russia, there has been an extraordinary campaign on the Russian television to present a very, very negative narrative of what's gone on in Kyiv. And there are certain issues where the Russians, I think, have legitimate concerns. I mean, the Russians don't want to see ethnic Russians in Ukraine mistreated, but it's very difficult to find credible instances where that's happening. Some of the things that the Russians talk about, for example, about some diffusion or some decentralization of power in Ukraine, probably would make sense. I mean, right now, does it make sense for the president of the country in Ukraine to appoint governors as opposed to having them elected locally? And my guess is that the Ukrainian government would be prepared to meet some of those issues halfway. So there could be, if the Russians are prepared to find a solution tomorrow, you can look at questions like some decentralization of power, which the government of Kyiv has wanted to do. The Russians are very concerned, what kind of relationship there is between Ukraine and NATO. The acting government has said that NATO is off the table for now, which I think is a very smart decision on their part because NATO would be hugely controversial within Ukraine. So there are some areas where you could begin to see some convergence, if the Russians don't come in with maximalist demands. The Russians, for example, have suggested that the Ukrainian constitution ought to give the right to individual provinces to basically secede if they disagree with Kyiv. That's something that no part of Russia has. But if there's a more reasonable approach, you could see a way forward on these questions. But we're not going to know until Mr. Lavrov gets to Geneva tomorrow whether that kind of approach is going to be possible.
But on the issue that you mentioned of alleged persecution of Russian-speaking Ukrainians in the East, even the United Nations has weighed in and said there's no evidence for that.
So exactly. But there was a concern. I think one of the acts on February 22nd, the Rada basically voted to overturn a 2010 law that had given Russian language special status. Now, we can debate the merits of whether or not that 2010 law made sense. I think, though, that the haste with which the Rada then moved to overturn that created concern in the East among some ethnic Russians and some Russian speakers. Are we now going to see an attempt to somehow restrict our language rights? Now, the acting president basically refused to sign the law into effect, so it never took effect. But I think this is a reflection, though, of perhaps a bigger question, which is when you look at the acting government in Kyiv, there aren't people there that the population in eastern Ukraine can point to and say, that person speaks for my political economic interests. Now, my understanding is that when they formed the government, they actually tried to bring in a couple members of the Party of Regions, which is primarily from eastern Ukraine, and the Party of Regions refused to join the government. So it's not strictly the government's fault that they don't have much representation from the east. But it's going to be, I think, very important for the government to reach out to the east and to signal that, you know, they're prepared to take account of the political and economic concerns there. It was a very good thing that Acting Prime Minister Yatsenyuk visited Donetsk last Friday. But the national leadership in Kyiv should be traveling to the eastern part of the country more to make them feel that the policies that are going to be conducted in Kyiv are an inclusive policy. And that may be one of the best ways to take the steam out of any support for these Russian-instigated actions that are going on.
But we were talking earlier about CIA Director John Brennan's trip to Kyiv and trying to figure out what that might have been about. And you mentioned the extent to which, you know, I'm paraphrasing here, but the extent to which the Russian security services, the SVR, really have that whole country wired. I mean, it looks to me like Putin has people all across that country, doesn't he?
Well, I think the Russians pay a lot of attention to Ukraine, and I think that it has been certainly a target of their intelligence efforts for the last couple of decades.
So at this point, then, what's your sense, Ambassador Pfeiffer? You're offering up some suggestions of how there could be some moves on the part of the government in Kyiv to defuse stuff and to be more inclusive. And then you've got these foreign ministers meeting tomorrow. So far, the meetings of the foreign ministers have not yielded anything. I assume that the one assumption you can make, I take it, is that as long as they're talking, they're not going to be shooting, right? So shooting's not going to break out for at least another 48 hours. Would that be your reading?
Well, I'm not sure. I mean, I think there's a tinderbox in eastern Ukraine, so I'm not sure you can guarantee that. But I think, again, the fact that they're meeting and they've got the right parties in the room is a good sign. The question is, will there be a chance to sort of explore some of these questions in a way that allows that meeting to begin to outline a path that gets to a dialogue that diffuses the crisis? And again, I'm just not sure, based on Russian actions and what the Russians have been saying for the last 2 weeks, that Mr. Lavrov, we just don't know what kind of approach he's going to come to the table with. And that seems to be the biggest factor that will determine the success or the failure of the meeting tomorrow.
But as far as Putin's concerned, being, you know, almost the absolute ruler, the new czar, so far things are working out incredibly well for him, are they not, politically? And at what point do you think there'll be a backlash or a wake-up call in terms of the long-term economic damage his move may be making to Russia's economy and its future and the future of its revenues coming from oil and gas? I mean, they are trying to pivot towards China, but at this point it looks as though all of his actions will lead the Europeans, who are dependent upon Russian gas in particular, to start looking for other markets.
Well, I think this is a very valid point, is that at this point in the Kremlin, they may feel that they're on a roll. But I think that there are unintended consequences that could come back to bite them. First of all, yesterday, the Russian finance minister revised the projection for Russia's GDP growth this year. He says 0.5%, but perhaps zero growth. That's down from an estimate 6 months ago of about 2 to 2.5% growth. There's an estimate that says that in the last 4 to 6 weeks, Russia's central bank has spent $25 billion to defend the ruble. And I've got to think that if you're an American or a European chief executive officer, now is not the time when you're going to your board of directors with a recommendation to make a major new investment in Russia. So, you know, there have been relatively modest sanctions applied by the United States and the European Union. Neither has declared a full-scale financial war on Russia, but the financial markets aren't waiting for that. They've already begun. So I think there's going to be an economic impact, which will be damaging to the Russian economy. We'll have to see if it has an impact on Mr. Putin's calculations or not. But I think there are other unintended consequences. I think Russia does run the risk of creating a large number of vehemently anti-Russian Ukrainians. because in the center of Ukraine, in West Ukraine, and even some parts of Eastern Ukraine, I think they see this as a Russian action that's designed to compromise their territorial, their integrity, their sovereignty. And so it's going to have, I think, a negative impact in much of Ukraine. And it's going to have a negative impact elsewhere. I mean, NATO right now is reexamining whether assumptions it made about NATO security are valid, given the very aggressive approach that you've seen the Russians take in Crimea and towards Ukraine. I expect one response is going to be that there will be a renewed decision by NATO to bolster the confidence of allies in the Baltics region and Central Europe. There have been some steps already taken, but I think there are going to be further steps basically to assure those allies of NATO's commitment to their security, but also to make clear to the Kremlin that there is a difference between eastern Ukraine and, say, Estonia, Latvia, Romania, which are members of the North Atlantic Alliance.
Well, Ambassador Pfeiffer, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Pfeiffer, who's the director of the Brookings Institute's Arms Control Initiative, where he focuses on arms control, Ukraine and Russian issues. He served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of State in the Bureau of European and Eurasian Affairs, U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, and Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director for Russia, Ukraine and Eurasia on the National Security Council. In addition to Kyiv, he has had postings in London, Moscow, Geneva and Warsaw, as well as on the National Security Council. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back with the former administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, who wrote a letter to GM's CEO Mary Barrick today talking about a smoking gun.
From Russia with love, I fly to you. Much wiser since my goodbye to you. I've traveled the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Joan Claybrook, who is the President Emeritus of Public Citizen, a non-profit public interest advocacy organization that seeks to protect consumer interests in policymaking, the former administrator at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1977 to 1981. She is currently working on issues including product liability, campaign finance reform, healthcare reform, trade and regulatory policies, and auto and highway safety. Welcome to Background Briefing, Joan Claybrook.
Thank you.
And as the former administrator of the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, you wrote a joint letter with Clarence Ditlow, the executive director of the Center for Auto Safety, to GM's CEO, Mary Barra, saying that these newly released GM documents are an obscure but smoking gun that, quoting, paints a tragic picture of the cost culture and cover-up at GM. So let's talk about the cost culture. What do you mean by that?
Well, in this particular case, General Motors designed first the proper spring device and plunger to go inside of a switch to turn on and off the engine of the early Saturn in 2003 and then the Cobalt in 2005. And then a month later, they designed a second one, which was less difficult to turn on, more likely to turn off on its own, and shorter. The plunger was shorter. And that was a cheaper version, we believe. We don't have any documentation of that, but it uses less materials. And so General Motors decided to select and use the less substantial version of this interior of the switch, and as a result, the switch would turn off on its own, cutting the power steering, the power brakes, and the airbag not working, and you couldn't obviously drive the car. And there have been a quite a number of accidents, a lot of injuries, at least 13 deaths. We believe more. And so for a few pennies, a switch, General Motors allowed its employees to do that. And as a result, we have unbelievable death and injury, damage to families, permanent damage, families in distraught.
So what does this say about this giant kind of, I guess you could call it a capitalist bureaucracy, GM? Is it really run by numbers crunchers and not by engineers and car makers?
Well, it appears to be, and there is a new CEO, and her name is Mary Bauer, and that's to whom we wrote the letter. She has been saying that she is not going to continue this cost culture at General Motors, but is going to have it put an emphasis on safety and protection of the customers. And she has appointed a new vice president for safety, and she is forming several other safety committees and so on. But the fact is that this is something that was known inside General Motors. She testified that she was not aware of any of the particulars. And yet, before she testified, the documents that we have highlighted today showing that they had a choice of which interior switch materials to use and chose the one that was most dangerous, that had already been submitted to the committee. So apparently no one ever told her that this had been already submitted to the committee. And unfortunately, because it's very detailed and technical and engineering ease in these drawings, it was not obvious. It took a long time to go through the documents and to sort these out. But we asked her, was she not briefed by her staff, her engineering staff, before she went and testified? Did she know that these documents had been submitted to the committee, and I presume also to the agency, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration? And, you know, why she didn't highlight this, that, you know, that this wrongdoing had occurred. So that's what we say in our letter. And also, of course, in 2006, for the 2007 models, when General Motors changed the switch to be the more substantial switch, they didn't do a recall of the vehicles that they had already made and sold, the Saturns and the Cobalts, that were where the switch was failing. And so they violated federal law by not doing that. And they also did not give a new part number to the new interior part of that switch so that it could be traced when the change was made. But apparently was made for the 2007 model sometime in the summer of 2006.
But starting in 2001, they started to have casualties and crashes, did they not?
Well, yes, they did. They realized there was a problem in 2001. I think that the model was a 2003, so it started in 2002. Mm-hmm. And they already had, yes, casualties and deaths and injuries and lawsuits, complaint letters. So they were aware of this for a few years before they made a change. And they talked to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration about the problem after that agency had done some crash investigations that were related to why the airbag didn't inflate. And the investigators all noted that the ignition switch was in the accessory position, which means that you could run the radio but not drive the car. And so they were aware that there was some problem with the switch, but they didn't know what it was. And so that's when they started talking to General Motors, and that was in 2007. And that was after General Motors had already made this change in the switch, and they never told the agency. They kept saying it was a confounding issue.
Again, I'm speaking with Joan Claybrook, who's the President Emeritus of Public Citizen, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization that seeks to protect consumer interest in policymaking, the former administrator at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1977 to 1981. She is currently working on issues including product liability, campaign finance reform, healthcare reform, trade and regulatory policies, and auto and highway safety. And along with Clarence Ditlow, the executive director of the Center for Auto Safety. Joan Claybrook wrote a letter to GM's CEO, Mary Barrett. Today it was, I take it.
Yes, we sent it this morning.
Talking about these newly released internal GM documents that reveal that the company in 2001 considered, then rejected, an ignition switch design that you and Clarence Ditlow say could have avoided the problem that led to the automaker to recall millions of vehicles. And when we're talking about 2.6 million cars that are now being recalled. And so this information, then, this came out in the documents that they sent to the Congress ahead of GM's CEO Mary Barra's testimony. And I guess it took a while to go through the fine print. Is that what happened?
Well, it's 200,000 documents.
Sure.
And these were drawings, which are engineering drawings, which are very difficult to evaluate. And so no one tried to evaluate them until the Center for Auto Safety looked at them and said, let's explore this further. These are the drawings dealing with the switch. And they consulted some other engineers and realized that there were two different switches designed in 2001, one a cheaper version, we believe, this the one that they selected to use. But they had previously designed one that was more substantial. And when they got into trouble in 2006 with people dying and switches turning off, they went back to the 2001 better design and put it in the new model vehicles, but they did not do a recall of the vehicles manufactured before the 2007s, and they never told the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, the federal regulator of the auto industry, that they had done this. They didn't give it a separate part number, so they made it very hard to trace, and also Delphi, the supplier of the systems, was not asked for any information about it, apparently, by the government. But they have now revealed that there was a part change.
Well, this sort of reminds me, Joan Claybrook, of the old adage from Watergate that the cover-up is worse than the crime. Is that the way you see it?
I do. I do see that. I think that it's people are going to be shocked about this. And it's really outrageous that a company that manufactures a dangerous, you know, product, which a car is a dangerous product, would allow it to have a switch that could turn off on its own and put people at risk. And I've never really heard of, I've heard of cars stalling, but I've never heard of a switch turning itself off. And so this is a very, very dangerous situation. It's an unreasonable risk to safety, which is the terminology in the federal statute that says what a safety defect is, an unreasonable risk to safety. And I also, of course, blame the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration for not fully investigating this, not using their subpoena power and other information gathering resources to demand from General Motors these kinds of documents. And so when the Congress scheduled hearings and demanded background documents on this, so then did the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, you know, very late, because this all occurred between 2001 and 2007. And so it's, you know, many, many years late and a lot of deaths and injuries. And they all didn't occur back then. These cars continue, you know, in use. And so that's why they're now being recalled, because they still have the old switch and they have to replace that. And so people are still liable, you know, for terrible crashes if you can't control the steering and if you have no accelerating power. You know, you can imagine yourself in the middle of traffic and, you know, people honking at you and wanting you to get out of the way or speed up or whatever, and you can't, you can barely turn the wheel, you can't apply the brakes very easily, and if you have a crash, the airbag's not going to inflate. That's just a terrible situation.
Well, I must say, Joan Claybrook, as a parent, when I saw those pictures of the 13 who died, and many of them were young teenage drivers, young women, and I thought of my own daughter. I mean, you know, when the first car is usually a small, compact, like the Cobalt or the Ion, and that I just find this really deeply tragic, and just looking at those pictures was really upsetting.
Well, it is, and we urge the families to come to Washington and to have a major press conference with us before Mary Barrow testified, so that people could see the faces of the families that have had these tragic losses. And the families were terrific. They went to see their members of Congress. They went to the hearing. They were not asked to testify. Hopefully, they will be asked to testify. There will be another hearing. And I think that this, revelation that we've just made available today, this smoking gun documents, will prompt another hearing, because it implies that Mary Barrow should have known about these, because they'd already given the documents to the committee, but she never told the committee.
So what is then the lesson for these big corporate behemoths and their CEOs and their boards of directors, given the nature of how much it's going to cost them now? Do you have the exact amount of money that was saved by putting this faulty switch in compared to the other one when they had the...
We don't have the exact amount of money that was saved, but it was probably pennies,
right?
And per car. And it's relatively small amount of money. The number of vehicles is 2.6 million, so you multiply that by some pennies. So it was in the millions of dollars, but that's relatively small for this kind of company. I mean, after all, Mary Barrow makes $14 million. So all they had to do was to cut her salary in half, and it would have paid for it. And so most people don't even think that making, $100,000 is going to be possible per year in their lifetime. And here she's making $14 million, and yet the company is counting pennies. So it's really... such a small amount of money for these huge companies. The highest penalty that the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration can impose on General Motors or any other big company for any particular violation of the law is $35 million. So, and that's definitely not enough money to change their behavior. But they do it on this switch and that bolt and whatever, and it all counts at the auto company. And I think that the lesson learned for them is that while they may not get caught on every one of these, they are going to get caught if they do this a lot. And they did get caught here. And it's going to cost them billions and billions of dollars between the cost of the recall, the cost of the sales loss from adverse publicity, the cost of whatever penalties they're going to have to pay to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, plus the possibility that they will have to pay criminal penalties to the U.S. Attorney of the Southern District of New York, who is doing an investigation and fined Toyota $1.2 billion. So it's cheaper to behave, as most people know, in their own personal lives, and it's cheaper for an auto company to behave in the long run.
Well, Joan Claybrook, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Joan Claybrook, who is the President Emeritus of Public Citizen, a nonprofit public interest advocacy organization that seeks to protect consumer interest in policymaking. The former administrator at the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration of the U.S. Department of Transportation from 1977 to 1981. She is currently working on issues including product liability, campaign finance reform, healthcare reform, trade and regulatory policies, and auto and highway safety. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking about former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg's $50 million challenge to the NRA. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Daniel Webster, Professor of Health Policy and Management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as Director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, Deputy Director of Research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and Director of the PhD Program in Health and Public Policy. He's the lead author of a study from the Journal of Urban Health that provides evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law led to an increase in the state's murder rate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Daniel Webster.
Thanks for having me.
And the former mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, has announced that he's going to pour $50 million into promoting gun sense. He's restructuring the gun control groups that he already funds, Mayors Against Illegal Guns and Moms Demand Action for Gun Sense in America. And they'll be brought together under a new umbrella group called Every Town for Gun Safety. So what's your sense, since you're there at the mayor's alma mater and he's poured a lot of money into Johns Hopkins? So what's your sense of how you're going forward here?
Well, I'll just be clear from the outset that even though I work for the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, Michael Bloomberg does not pay my salary and nor involve me in his decision making relevant to his advocacy on this issue. Because we do generate research that is designed to inform gun policy, he and his group, of course, are very interested in our research findings. So, in my opinion, it's no secret that Michael Bloomberg is reducing gun violence is at the top or near the top of his many issues that he cares about deeply. And so, to me, I'm not surprised that he's decided to invest in this. He's contributed money in the past to a variety of different groups working on this issue. I think what he's trying to do, of course, is to level the playing field that we've had for decades, of course, in the United States, the gun lobby, the most powerful force, of course, being the National Rifle Association, has played an outsized role in shaping our gun policy, given that its views are quite at odds with the public overall, and even gun owners or even their own members on many key issues, perhaps most important being background checks. So, I think that what this organization is trying to do is to mobilize this large majority so that they care as deeply as a very small group that's been able to dictate gun policy for so long.
So in trying to outmuscle the NRA, which its political action committee spent more than $16 million in the 2012 election cycle, and it's raised more than $13.7 million already in 2014 and spent only a fraction of that, it's worth pointing out that much of the NRA's money comes from the gun and ammunition manufacturers, and that it does try to portray itself as a grassroots American movement, but it's essentially a lobbying group, is it not, for gun and ammunition manufacturers?
Well, there's no question in my mind that the gun industry plays a very large role in shaping what the National Rifle Association does. There certainly are a very committed group of gun owners themselves who agree with and support the policies of that organization. So it's not as though there's no grassroots support. But it's very interesting in surveys that we've done, but surveys that many different organizations have done over time. There is a very, very large gap between what your average gun owner wants and supports for gun policy and the policies of the NRA and what they support. The way I would characterize that generally is that very large majorities of gun owners support policies to keep guns out of the wrong hands, out of the hands of dangerous people. It's not a particular controversial thing for them, the idea that you would require background checks, that you would prohibit certain groups from possessing firearms and put the necessary regulation in place to keep guns from them. The thing that, you know, types of policies that gun owners don't support are, you know, bans, assault weapon bans, or restrictions on concealed carry. But the kind of policies that are designed to keep guns out of the hands of criminals and other dangerous people, which from my following of mayors against illegal guns, because it's been in place for a longer time, that has been the area of their focus and interest. And I suspect that this grassroots group will, you know, they read the opinion polls. They know what policies have the biggest support. So I suspect that they're going to focus most of their energies on where this grassroots movement is, which is they want policies to keep guns from dangerous people.
Again, I'm speaking with Daniel Webster, the professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, deputy director of research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and director of the PhD program in health and public policy. He's the lead author of a study from the Journal of Urban Health that provides evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law led to an increase in the state's murder rate. Now, in terms of background checks, which certainly do have a lot of popular appeal, nevertheless, the NRA was able to spend enough money to get rid of the president of Colorado's Senate, John Morse. They recalled him over his support for background checks and limiting magazine capacity. So the message, I mean, it's clear that he could have done with some more support from the gun control or the gun sense people now. I guess that's the new way of framing it, right? It's not about gun control, which obviously raises hackles.
Yeah.
It's about common sense.
Exactly. I think language is very important here, how you characterize these policies. I have to say it sort of rankles me when I read in the media when people talk about background checks as gun restrictions. Well, what's being restricted is the people who already prohibit are being restricted because they have to have a background. You know, background checks keeps the guns from them. But something like background checks is common sense. So we need new ways to talk about, you know, things like background checks as being very distinct and different from any kind of ban, for example.
Well, we already have, I mean, I don't know how much more evidence you can get. And, you know, the president was obviously, and the Democrats simply couldn't remain silent after the Newtown massacre. They've avoided talking about gun control or even gun safety. Obviously, you've got a lot of these senators in like Heidi Heitkamp in North Dakota, Mark Begich in Alaska, Mark Pryor in Arkansas, who definitely have to sing the NRA's tune, otherwise they get booted out. And then on the Republican side, only four Republican senators voted for background checks. That's Pat Toomey, John McCain, Susan Collins, and Mark Kirk. So the NRA certainly got pretty much the entire Republican Party in their pocket, and they've cowed a few Democrats. But for example, just a couple of days ago, a neo-Nazi with an extraordinarily long record of violence and stealing high-powered, heavy military weapons from U.S. armories, etc., he, through a straw purchase, got a gun that killed. He tried to shoot up a Jewish community center in Kansas and ended up killing some Christian visitors to the center. You know, to me, it's just piling on. The evidence is so overwhelming. But how come it never quite breaks through the overall consciousness of the country that there are simply people out there that should not have access to firearms?
Well, I actually do think that there is a consensus that certain people should not have firearms. And I actually also think there's a consensus that we should have common sense things like background checks for all gun sales. I think where things sort of get off the rails, we get distracted, frankly, because the gun lobby is particularly adept at, in essence, changing the subject. And it plays right into many formulaic media responses to this issue, because they want to hype up the controversy and say, and underscore a cultural conflict. Again, this sort of classic pro and anti-gun portrayal of the issue. But in my opinion, it's not a pro and anti-gun kind of thing, because the vast majority of gun owners support something like background checks. So I think it's we're in a bit of a rut where we keep talking about this in not particularly productive ways, in which we lose sight of what the issue is. Is the issue, are guns good or bad? No, I don't think that's really the issue. I think the issue is what policies should we put in place to reduce gun violence and keep guns from dangerous people. It doesn't have to be a pro and anti-gun kind of debate. And I think if the new group that's being formed now sort of sticks to that and doesn't get sucked into the cultural war dimension to this, I think in the long term they'll probably be successful.
So when Mayor Bloomberg, in launching this new effort, this $50 million effort called Every Town for Gun Safety, in launching the effort, he said, this is not a battle of dollars. This is a battle for the hearts and minds of America so that we can protect our children, protect innocent people. If you take a look at the number of people who use illegal guns to commit suicide, the number of people that are killed every year, we're the only civilized country in the world that has this problem. Very rational, reasonable, but sometimes, you know, by simply being rational and reasonable in the tradition of the Enlightenment, the Age of Enlightenment, the argument is sometimes that because you make the reasonable and rational argument, you assume that you've won, but you haven't won, right?
No, you're absolutely right. So I think, again, this is going to require time, a new way of thinking about how to address this. Again, I think we don't have big social change that occurs, you know, that things change immediately. But I sense that after the horrific tragedy in Newtown, that far more people are engaged in reforming policies to make our communities safer, reforming gun policies. And so I am guardedly optimistic that we can start to talk about and think about this problem a little bit differently and more productively.
And in terms of the intersection between mental illness and easy access to weaponry, I mean, the strongest arguments to my mind are that argument, the argument that America has the most heavily armed, sophisticatedly armed criminals in the world, that, you know, there's absolutely, the police are outgunned in this country. It's a phenomenon that no other country has, this situation where criminals can purchase military-style weapons or find them one way or the other. That seems to be a strong argument. So how do you rate these arguments in terms of, again, you know, breaking through that idea that just because you are rational and reasonable doesn't mean you're going to win the argument?
I think it comes down to trust, honestly. I think that the NRA has been successful in large part because they've instilled fear in people. They've instilled fear relevant to crime and criminals. But perhaps far more importantly, they've instilled fear of what it means to regulate guns. They have been convinced that something as simple as a background check is simply a ploy to take away everyone's guns. And, you know, there's just a lot of distrust in this country now of government. And again, there's a cultural and political divide that's been growing, and it's not simply a gun-related thing. But the NRA takes advantage of that, takes advantage of people's distrust of government, and ties that to the reasonable types of regulations over firearms. So, you know, I think part of this is not only convincing people that these policies can work, which again I think is a barrier. The NRA has been somewhat successful in convincing people that it's impossible to keep guns from dangerous people. That the criminals are always going to find their ways to get guns. Well, that's just simply not true. Yes, there are some criminals who will be very resourceful and determined to arm themselves, even when there are strong gun laws. But the fact of the matter is a lot of criminals do not have a lot of resources, do not necessarily have the connections, and do not want to risk breaking law and going to jail. So there's a number of hurdles to get over. One is sort of this disbelief that it can work, but then secondly, that you can regulate guns and not threaten lawful gun ownership. I think that's sort of the bottom line.
Well, you do have this disconnect, if not hypocrisy, where the red states and the rural states that are vehemently in support of gun rights, with the notion that the government's going to take their guns away, and yet they live in states where there's little crime, little need for guns in the sense that you need to defend yourself. But they're also, these states are the source of most of the gun running that takes place, that guns come from these red states, go into these big urban centers where the real shooting takes place and the real casualties takes place. So, you know, urban America is suffering because of rural America's, you know, hypocrisy.
Well, there's certainly a connection between where the guns are coming from, those being places that have the weakest gun laws, and where they commonly are used, which you're right, is more urban areas. And that underscores why it's particularly important to have federal laws. Again, trying to be guardedly optimistic, my hope is that I grew up in a small town in a rural community in Kentucky. I don't think that everybody's of one mind on guns and responsible gun ownership and things like that. So my hope is that, again, you can break through this distrust and have people accept common sense, reasonable regulations that won't threaten their ability to possess firearms, and in essence, sort of take some responsibility for what happens to the guns that are initially sold in your own state.
Well, Daniel Webster, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Daniel Webster, who's a professor of health policy and management at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, where he serves as director of the Center for Gun Policy and Research, deputy director of research for the Center for the Prevention of Youth Violence, and director of the PhD program in health and public policy. He's the lead author of a study from the Journal of Urban Health that provides evidence of how the repeal of Missouri's background check law led to an increase in the state's murder rate. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.